On this week's 51%, a woman nearing 80 is on a mission to introduce the world to Indonesian literature.
This is a chance I have to contribute to bringing my country's literature to the world. And I really want to do that. It will be the last thing I do.
Then we visit Zambia to learn what is being done to decrease the number of teen pregnancies, and we'll hear about a young woman's campaign to put an end to a human rights violation. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Leon Gao is a California-based publisher on a mission to introduce Indonesian literature to the world. Gao immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1960s and has returned to her country of birth just a few times and just in the past 5 years. Yet she says she still has roots and a strong pull to tell Indonesia's story through the lens of its writers. She started her publishing company in 2011, Dalang Publishing, and will have 10 titles come June 2015. That's when the Frankfurt Book Fair is held, and Indonesia is the guest of honor. Leon Gao is also the author of Only a Girl. Another of the works published by Dalang is written by the late Indonesian feminist Lan Fong, author of Potions and Paper Cranes. I asked Gao what Lan Fong would say or do about today's push for women's equality in the U.S. and Indonesia.
She would be right behind it and continue to advocate equality and continue to help underprivileged children that come from homes like that. And she would encourage education.
You have this book translated, and so if someone were to read this book, what is your hope, or what do you think her hope would be if one message were taken away from the book? What would that be?
That people would understand that regardless of whatever hard circumstance they are under, as long as they have a love and a hope, that is life.
I wanted to ask you about your book, because obviously you're not only a publisher, but an author in your own right, and wanted to know if you would talk a bit about your book and why you wrote that, and again, what you would hope audiences here would take away from it.
My book is about three generations of Chinese women who grew up in Indonesia during the colonial time. And it addresses the problems of women in the Chinese sector of Indonesia, which is a very different position, but also it is where the where the women have very little say, and it is these three generations of women that are trying to, in their own way, and in their own generation, shall we say, find ways to overcome and get out of that situation. It is a fight, again, for independence. So basically, both Potions and Only a Girl strive to bring to the foreground the importance of independence.
And it sounds like you're talking about independence from the point of view of not only colonialism, but independence for a woman, just in her own
yes.
right, you know, within a family structure, within a community, whatever the case is. Is there a common thread among the novels that you're publishing, among the books that you're publishing, to be able to say, you know, they all have such and such in common, or is that not true?
It definitely is true, because we focus on historical novels. Each of the novels that I publish in story or through story gives a glimpse at Indonesian history, one way or another. So that's definitely a thread of our publications, our saying, Dalang Publishing. And just Dalang is the Indonesian word for master storyteller. When I opened my publishing company, I thought that was a fitting name.
Do you relate more heavily with certain authors here in the U.S.?
I love, of course, Toni Morrison and Jamaica Kincaid for openers. Maya Angelou, Sandy Cisneros.
What is it that you're drawn to with these authors?
The theme. Most of them also address the place of women and the suppressed segment of the population and humanity and equal rights. Humanity is a big, big component of it all. Without humanity, we are no one. And that is something that I really want to bring out in the work I publish.
Wanted to skip ahead to something a little more lighthearted, and that is you're the Indonesia's the guest of honor, right, at the 2015 Frankfurt Book Fair. And
yes.
You know, and what does that mean to you?
Oh, it means right now, it means a nervous headache because I have to really work very, very hard to get these translations pumped out. I would not have dreamt to have a title list of 10 by June next year if it were not for the Frankfurt. But I really, this is a chance I have to contribute to bringing my country's literature to the world. And I really want to do that. It will be the last thing I do. You know, it's very important to me. It is a big honor to be the guest of honor at the Frankfurt Book Fair, but it also requires a tremendous amount of work. And for a country like Indonesia, it is even double hard than for, like, let's say, established countries like the European countries, like America, where things have been organized for quite a long time in the literary sense. So it's a big, big undertaking.
Is this a way for you to stay attached to the country of your birth? What is it that you want to see happen or affect?
I would like to see Indonesian literature come to its own rights. I would like to see it acknowledged. I would like to see it known for the sheer reason that it tells Indonesia's story. It tells about the country. It tells about the many, many cultures. It tells about its history. And I think as a nation, it is the largest archipelago. It is the fourth most populated country. By numbers alone, it should be known. It should be known for its soul, for what it is. And that's what I'm after.
That was Leon Gao, founder of Dalang Publishing. Next, we travel to Zambia, which is struggling to cope with an increasing number of teenage pregnancies. Assumpta Lattice reports.
Sex education is still a taboo in the Zambian society. However, experts have warned that the time has come for Zambia to speak up about sexuality. Jani Conrad is a youth counselor at Youth Alive, a non-government organization dealing with youth reproductive health issues.
The numbers of young people who are getting HIV infections and STIs has increased amongst the lower group of young people. We talk of those that are maybe 15 and lower, and even the teenage pregnancies, we have high statistics amongst that group of young people. For those that are above 15, maybe 18, 19, we are a little bit safe, though we still have a lot more work to do.
12-year Mutinta Beani learnt the hard way as she is now 4 months pregnant. She has this warning to her age mates.
I'm so confused. No one told me what to do, so just happened. I'm so confused. My mommy is very upset at me and also my father. I'm very confused. Please listen to what your parents say. Do not do things without you knowing. If you don't know what it is, then don't do it at all.
Precious Daka is a teacher at Temwani School in the capital, Lusaka. She says parents and teachers need to work together to help young people learn about sexuality.
Children really need to be educated about sex matters. You know, they really need to take precautions. So I think there hasn't been much sex education in most schools, I should say. Okay, it has to start from home, but again, the teachers have to put in something, at least to help out. I think it's not too late. You can still educate them. Those who have gone on maternity, they can still come back to school and learn.
Boniface Chembe, a human rights activist, says the advocacy on gender equality has focused more on girls than boys. Chembe says there is need for a balance since boys also need help.
We have not fully understood, or we have somewhat misinterpreted what is meant by gender equality. In Zambia, we've understood it as making the girl child become more privileged as opposed to the boy child, because of the perception that the boy child has been preferred for a long period of time. So I think there is need to refocus our understanding of what is meant by gender equality to ensure that, yes, in as much as we try to propel the status of the girl child, we also ensure that the boy child is given a platform to allow him to also fulfill the objectives of his life project.
Chongo Mwila, a spokesperson at the Ministry of Education, acknowledges the problem and says the government is looking into the matter.
As a country, Zambia is well known for having some of the best policies. If you look at our adolescent strategic plan or our national health policy, we've got many ideas that for things that we want to do, but when you go on the ground, really, you find that there's a lot of gaps. And so now, using the evidence from our research, we're going to be advocating now for reform of policy, or at least addressing the policies that we have on the shelf and finding out why is it that there are such gaps between what we have written and what's actually happening.
The World Health Organization says teenage pregnancy in Zambia has adverse social consequences. Girls have sex earlier than the boys, and they are less likely to use condoms. It is estimated that 28% of young females aged 15 to 19 years have begun childbearing.
That was reporter Assumpta Lattas.
We're born with eyes wide open, so alive with wild hope now. Can you tell me why time after time they drag you down?
The United Nations has called it a human rights violation, but the practice of cutting the sex organs of young girls and women, also known as female genital mutilation or FGM, is still practiced on girls around the world. Until recently, governments have been unwilling to engage with the issue because it is deeply rooted in the cultures that practice it. However, more and more women are speaking out about the practice in a bid to stop it for good. Lindsay Melling reports about a young Somali woman living in England who is campaigning against the practice of FGM.
It's a big day for Muna Hassan and the charity she helped found, Integrate Bristol.
Okay, hello Muna, how are you?
Hi, I'm very good.
Can you tell me where we are today?
We're at our big summer launch, which is sort of aimed at raising awareness on FGM. It's really good. I've been really excited all day, and it's really nice to have everyone be on the same page and wanting to end FGM altogether.
they're here to discuss a very serious subject, female genital mutilation, cutting the sex organs of young girls and women. For Muna, this subject is very close to home. Her family is Somali, but she was born in Sweden. She moved to the UK when she was 9 and grew up in a diverse community in Bristol. While she was at school, girls would mysteriously disappear in the summer holidays and return to school having had an operation. But Muna's parents never talked to her about FGM. It wasn't until a teacher told her about the practice that she decided to look into it herself and realised it was common in the Somali community.
And then it was from there I kind of felt like, okay, I need to do something. It was kind of like that instinct that I got straight away as soon as I read some sort of the facts and statistics that I had to do something. And then I went back home and I told my mum, I was like, Mum, like, what is this? She kind of sat down with me and kind of explained it and kind of went, you know, we always thought that you didn't have to know about that, but you were bound to find out. Someone I knew who was within sort of my peer group kind of told me that she'd gone through it, and that completely threw me off because we were really young at that time as well, and I was just starting off the work, and that pushed me to do the work even more because I realised she might have been one of the girls that told me that she'd gone through this, but they were definitely more out there.
Muna's teacher, Lisa Zimmerman, encouraged her and 3 of her friends to write poems about the issue.
And so we stayed after school, and they'd be literally turning the screens off if anyone came too close. And if you read the poems, I'm not sure that you'd know they were about FGM. It was really very vague, but some other girls started getting interested in what they were doing and asking questions. And the next year we had 12, and they wanted to make some kind of media project. And they made a drama doc for radio, which ended up being featured on BBC, which was quite an achievement at the time.
But with their success in getting the issue of FGM on national radio, they faced anger from their own community.
And there was quite a few men in the community that kind of went, actually, we don't want them doing this work, and so we're going to try and get the school to stop doing it, trying the girls to sort of harass us.
It was quite aggressive, to be honest, and it included a couple of people who worked at the school at that time. It was very difficult. Some girls were bullied out of the project. They did rejoin, but at the time it was quite scary. I found out that the principal had had a call from the police saying 75 irate elders are on the way to the school. And he was absolutely terrified. In the end, only 35 of these men turned up to make a complaint.
The following year, more girls joined the project and they decided to make a film about FGM. It won them a national award, but also more complaints.
There was a man who was calling up the girls' parents, being very aggressive about it, and there was somebody who worked in the school who was trying to stop the showcasing because we'd booked the local cinema to have a big sort of celebration of their work. And the girls were absolutely... I mean, I remember one day, Muna and several others were standing outside the principal's office crying because they thought their film wasn't going to get shown, and they were so proud of it, and it had been so much work. And then in the end, the three mothers in particular, organised a secret meeting with the police in one of the houses, and other women went there as well, and they demanded that the police support them, which, of course, they were happy to. So we ended up going to the watershed with a full police escort.
And it was because that it was the mothers and these women who were so strong and were saying, enough is enough, like, these girls are going to do the work, that it carried on, but it kind of gave all the other women and all the other girls courage to carry on as well, because it was like, if they can stand up to these bullies and all these people who are saying no, then so can we.
After overcoming the opposition to their campaigns, Muna and her friends have achieved great things for the project, including meeting UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and getting the UK Education Secretary to write to all schools about FGM. Her teacher, Lisa, has watched Muna make that transition over the last 8 years.
Well, she's grown hugely in confidence, but I think, I mean, I remember one moment in particular when she was 15, and I just said to Muna, look, here's the House of Lords, call them and ask to speak to these people. And she said, OK, and she took the phone and she called the House of Lords, and she got 4 of them on the phone. And I just thought, she starts off by saying, I'm a Somali girl and I'm working on a project about FGM. And I thought, OK, well, I wouldn't have got through because I couldn't have claimed that.
I think people, when they hear the message, I think it's not necessarily me, but it's the message that I bring. I think that's when they listen to me.
Lindsay Melling, DW, Bristol, England.
Photos of the rape and murder of 2 teenage girls in India over the summer were shocking. But as Sandeep Roy explains, the story behind this is layered. And should the photographs that ended up going viral on social media have been published?
Sometimes a picture is not worth 1,000 words. India was shocked by a picture that looked ripped out of the American South from decades ago. two young women raped and strangled and then left dangling from a mango tree in a village in the Badaun district of the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. The two girls, cousins, both teenagers, poor lower caste Dalits, had gone out at dusk to the fields because their homes had no toilets. They never came back. When the father went to complain to the police, they didn't pay him much attention. The police belonged to the Yadav group, also a backward caste, but higher up the pecking order and owning land. And the men suspected of abducting the girls were Yadavs as well. The next morning, the girls were found dangling from a mango tree by their own headscarves. Those photographs went viral in social media. Some blasted it as the pornography of rape. But the pictures, shocking as they are not worth a thousand words because they cannot begin to unravel the context behind the story. It's a story that's not just about rape. It's about caste and power and property, and that includes the bodies of women. It's about who owns land and who works on them. It's about how the lack of toilets translates into the lack of safety. It's about not just raping someone, but also making an example of them. And certainly no photograph can begin to convey how the conviction rates for the rape accused in India plummet when the victim is a Dalit woman and the perpetrator non-Dalit. In India, there is rape, and then there is rape. In 1916, Jesse Washington, a teenaged black farmhand, was lynched in Waco, Texas, accused of raping and murdering the wife of his white employer. A professional photographer took pictures of the event, and they were printed and sold as postcards. W.E. Du Bois used those photographs on the cover of the NAACP's newsletter. He pushed for it, saying it would shock white America into supporting their anti-lynching campaign. The photographs didn't end lynching, but in her book, Lynching and Spectacle, Amy Louise Wood says, with it, lynching began to sow the seeds of its own collapse. Could the Dalit girls of Badaun be a Waco moment for India's rape crisis? Unlikely. In 1916 America, the public at large could pretend that lynching was not really an issue because it happened far away from them. In 21st century India, there is no spot that is safe from rape. Not an abandoned mill in Mumbai, a public bus in Delhi, a taxi in Kolkata, or a village in Haryana. But the pictures did create a furor, embarrassing politicians. Police officers were suspended, suspects were rounded up, now we hear some have confessed. That led some people to say that this is an exceptional case where perhaps sharing those pictures actually led to action. In 1916 America, it might have been against good taste to publish those photographs, but it was not against the law. Indian law does not allow revealing the identity of the rape victim for reasons of social stigma. And many fear that even the best of intentions in this case mean going down a slippery slope, making it that much easier to make another exception the next time around. But the more troubling thought is, if indeed we now need to see the strange fruit on our mango trees to be shocked, it begs the question about what kind of people we have become anyway. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1316. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%.